Welcome to the Swim and Tell Spotlight. I am Jamie Bailey, and I am super excited about today's guest. Coach Greg Perini has been coaching at Denison for 38 seasons and built an absolute powerhouse of a program. He's won 7 national titles, 24 conference titles, and was named NCAA D3 Coach of the Year 11 times. He was also named one of the 100 greatest college swimming coaches in the past century by the CSCAA. Coach Perini, it is great to have you on today.
Good morning, Jimmy. Good to be with you. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
All right. So you've been at Denison for almost 4 decades. You know, most coaches, they would have jumped around chasing other programs, but you've stayed here the whole time. So why? Like, what makes Denison such a special place?
I think it's a multi-layer response. I think first and foremost, it's an institution that's very forward-thinking. There's a lot of institutional growth here, which equates to professional growth for me personally. The university has experienced exponential growth since I arrived here. It's been great to partner with the university in that effort, you know, contributing where we can, both in the classroom and in the pool. It's been a source of pride and satisfaction for me. And in order to be able to sustain that, you know, you need to be able to find new horizons. And Denison has been really supportive in allowing me to develop professionally as well as personally through the job, finding multiple ways for me to contribute to the community and the university. On the other side of that, part of that is just a lot of it was driven by family considerations. You know, my wife and I are the parents of 6 sons. All the boys were born and raised here in Granville. This is home. This is home base, despite the fact that they are literally living around the world, and in all sorts of different hemispheres. I think we're spread out by about 19 different time zones right now. This is still home base for them. And it was important for my wife and I to be able to provide our kids with a stable home front that way. And we knew moving around a lot, chasing jobs, whatever it might be, would create a certain level of instability for them that, you know, that we just favored staying here for family reasons as much as professional.
Were you ever tempted to leave? Has it been just a non-starter the whole time?
Well, no, I've been flattered and humbled enough to a number of other programs have approached me about maybe, taking a look at their opportunity, their positions there and have gotten into some discussions with them. But ultimately it was a family decision that kept me here, as well as the professional opportunities that Denison offered me, the opportunity to be a faculty member here and to teach on top of coaching was certainly a plus. I'm a bit of a dinosaur that way. When I got into the game, there were a lot of us who were not only head coaches, which is typically an administrative contract, but also some of us who also had faculty status. And for me to be able to maintain faculty status here at Denison has been an important piece of my professional experience. And It was going to take a lot for me to leave, that's for sure. And I just never found the grass greener on the other side of the fence.
You know, that's something that I found that was really unique about you, you know, not just being a coach, but also a professor. And you've not just been any professor, you've won awards for teaching, and you even chaired a department for a while. I mean, you know, that's like a whole other level of responsibility and workload that most coaches don't want to take on. So why did you want to take on both? Why did you want to be a coach and a teacher? And do you think it made you a better coach?
I'm eclectic in my interests. I've got interests that go well beyond the swimming pool. And a lot of those are academically driven interests, and a lot of questions, just kind of a curious mind as much as anything. But I also felt like for me to fully embrace the student and student athlete experience here, I had to immerse myself in the academic and the administrative end of things. Yeah, it was a lot of work. Some of those hills were pretty long and pretty steep, but they enriched my life in a great way. But it also gave me opportunities to see my students and my student athletes in a different light. I got a chance to share in their academic struggles and challenges and opportunities in a real way. Rather than just from you know, arm's length, I got a chance. I mean, a lot of my students were my swimmers, and get a chance to watch them, and hear their stories and goals, aspirations, fears, anxieties related to academics. I think it did make me a better coach. It helped me. It gave me another way to relate to them, to have some shared territory, so to speak. So I think the opportunity to teach it was not only enriched my life and enriched the, but it also, and I think it also gave my athletes a chance to see me in a different light, which I think was really, really important. They saw, wow, there's more to this guy than just simply a coach. He's got this academic and intellectual side that he wants to pursue and wants to share with us. And I think it did add a certain level of depth in those relationships. And they got a chance to know me. I got a chance to know them a little bit better through those shared experiences. And so I think it, the windfall, I mean, sure, there were some hard moments and, you certainly get a little bit tired doing it, but I think the windfall certainly outweighed any of the deficits that came along with it.
Yeah, no, that's it's just really interesting. Okay, so let's go back to when you started at Denison. So
Sure.
back when you started, Kenyon was, this unstoppable powerhouse. They were dominating everything, men's side, women's side. And then in 2011, your men's team actually snapped Kenyon's 31-year title streak, which, crazy enough, that was a streak that you helped start when you swam at Kenyon. So when you started, did you have a master plan for how you were going to build your program, one that could actually win a national title, or did that plan just kind of evolve over time?
Well, I, you know, I, as I, as I, as I tell my team, I came in with a 4-year plan and I'm still working on it. I had, I mean, I think even as an undergrad, having been a swimmer at Kenyon, and having competed against Denison, for 4 years, I, even as a student athlete, I recognized and saw the potential that a place like Denison had for developing a quality swimming and diving program. And so in the opportunity for me to come to Denison availed itself. I was quick to jump on it just simply because I saw the potential of it. I don't think I had a very firm grasp of all the challenges that were going to come my way. I don't think anybody does until you get into the weeds. But I had a vision that we could turn Denison into something special. It was a slow evolution. I mean, if I had it my way, the women won in 2001, men in 2011. Those are like my 13th and my 23rd years here. I would, if it was my way, I wouldn't have taken that long. But that's how things go. But I think for me to be able to get traction on the vision here, I had to have a really good understanding of what the university's strengths and weaknesses were, and how I could shape what we were trying to do here to take advantage of what Denison had to offer. And that just takes time. I mean, if anything, my old man just used to call me stubborn, just simply because he's like, you just won't let go of this vision. And I think there's a certain amount of that. I don't think anybody would ever accuse me of being lazy or easily frustrated, because the reality is, swimming in Kenyon's shadow for so long, I mean, I can make the argument nobody's finished second place more than I have, but it also just took a long time for us to kind of chip away at that mystique, to chip away at that formidable shadow that they did cast. But I also knew if we were close to them, that was the best way to compete. We would learn best if we're, if we, tried to share the yard with the big dog. And I think it did prove to be true. It just took a little longer than I might have wanted it to.
So when you started, was recruiting the biggest challenge, just getting those athletes to Denison, or was it, getting a staff together? What were some of the bigger challenges early on that you slowly chipped away at?
Well, I don't think I would have articulated this as a 27-year-old, but culture trumps strategy every time. And I think for me, the most important piece was creating a team culture that would, I think, provide us with the resources to be competitive at the highest levels. It took a long time to get there. And I think the one thing, especially when we're talking about college program, every college university has a certain gravitational pull within its student culture. And then each athletic team, I think, has a gravitational pull too. And I think the most successful programs, ultimately, those gravitational pulls are pulling everybody along in the same direction. Where things become more challenging is when a coach or a program finds itself in a position where the cultural vector is a little bit different than maybe the university's vector. And so I think for a long time, it was trying to figure out exactly where the university was going and how I could best leverage that culture to where we could build a program here. And quite honestly, it wasn't always particularly well aligned. It took us a while to get better alignment. But I think we're there now institutionally. And I think we're, I think the swimming and diving program culture aligns itself really well now with university culture. That was probably the biggest challenge, though, was just getting those cultural pieces in place. And I had a fascinating conversation with Mark Schubert my very first year here at Denison. Happened to run into him at a state meet. As it turns out, we were recruiting the exact same person. Here's Schubert coaching at USC, and here I am, a first year coach at Denison, and we're coaching this young lady, a backstroker from Ohio, and I won't mention names or anything like that, but Mark and I happened to be sitting at the Ohio High School state meet next to each other, and we introduced each other and we started sharing stories. And the question came up, because I think he was pretty new at USC at this time, was how long does it take to change team culture within Division I and Division III? And he thought it would take about 4 years at a D1 level to shift the culture, but as a result of having scholarship money available that he and but. Maybe in a D3 setting, it would take maybe twice as long. That was his conclusion. He goes, "Greg, I think this is going to take you twice as long as it would me, simply because you don't have that scholarship leverage to shape your team in the same way." And I do think there's probably some truth to that. I mean, again, it took me a little longer to get where I wanted to, but I think we eventually got there. But having said all that, there's no finish line because that cultural thing just keeps shifting all the time.
And I think it's the same whether, you're a coach on a sports team or, you're leading a team in the business world or starting a company. The one thing that I've learned is that, you can't create a culture. Culture happens. You can create culture norms, right? And you can set vectors in place, but ultimately it's a multivariable problem and the culture will happen. And it's up to you to try to kind of push it along the way. And it's a really complicated problem. And it does take a while.
It's a very complex issue, and I think too often we get caught up in the X's and O's in the details, when in fact there's much bigger issues influencing your team. I mean, one of the things I'm grateful for now is that I feel, when you're fighting that cultural battle, you can write the greatest workout ever, but if you don't have the right people implementing, it doesn't matter how good that workout is. Conversely, if you've got the right culture in place or things are moving in the right direction, you can write a mediocre workout, and the best people will th turn that into gold. They're almost, and so that's why cultural influences are so important. And we hammer it here. I mean, we are very intentional about it, so much that we went out and hired our own culture coach here.
Wow.
We have a director of team culture development, a young lady who swam for me here back in 2001. Then she went on to get her PhD and work in the corporate world for a long time. And she came back to Central Ohio, and we hired her to do the same sorts of things here that she was doing in the corporate world. And probably one of the best things we've ever done.
Yeah, if you have a great culture, it really cultivates motivation. And again, corporate world, sports world, doesn't matter, right? If you have motivated, driven people, they do amazing things. But if you have people that are frustrated, they don't feel like they have a place, it doesn't work. It doesn't matter what kind of all stars you have. And that's really interesting. You have someone that's focused on the culture piece because I think that's really smart.
Well, again, we've been doing it for a while now, and it's probably one of the more important steps we took in the evolution of the program. It helped get all that energy and let's say the culture vectors all pointed in the right direction. We got much better alignment now than we ever have.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got this incredible pool, the Trumbull Aquatic Center, right? It's been called one of the best pools in the country, not just D3, but all divisions across the country, right? Do facilities like that, do they make a big difference in recruiting and performance, or is it more just kind of a cherry on top thing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what most parents, what most, prospective students and families are looking for is, I think they're looking for a certain energy and indication that the programs are evolving and developing. And, we had the old 6-lane, 25-yard pool at the Gregory Natatorium. I coached in that facility for 25 years. And it had its issues. I mean, we had all sorts of, mechanical and, physical plant issues with that. We were able to build some championship teams out of that program. But at the same time, it also at times felt like a bit of an anchor, simply because it was holding us back. And when we did build the new facility, I think in the public's mind, I was like, oh, Denison's investing in swimming now. This is something that's important. It was a reflection of the university's motivation and intent. And from that standpoint, I think it energized, the way people viewed Denison. It's like, wow, okay, they've got some forward thinking going on there, and it's reflected in this brand new facility that they built.
Yeah, I had a years ago, I had a parent sitting beside me at a meet, and he pulls his phone out and he says, my son visited Kenyon, but I drove over to Denison, and he starts showing me all these pictures of the pool. And he was just so impressed by the pool. And it's amazing. And it's gotta be a lot of fun to practice and to compete there.
Well, I remember talking to Jack Barley down in Georgia, because Jack, when I got started, we had all sorts of issues, and I was talking to Jack about his old pool, and I remember him sharing stories. He goes, yeah, when we have recruits on campus, I don't even take them to the pool to see it anymore. It's so bad. And I said, well, Jack, I would love nothing more than to get a brand new facility. And he goes, Greg, be careful what you ask for on that one, because it will create problems that you could never expect. And I remember one of the big challenges that we had, because we used to run double workouts every afternoon in the old facility simply because we couldn't get our athletes through. Then all of a sudden, you're offered, instead of 6 lanes, you got 21 lanes to work with. And instead of having a smaller crew of 30 in the pool that you're working with, all of a sudden, you've got 60 plus athletes in the pool, and the issues that dynamic created were something I would never have guessed. I'm just excited. Okay, I don't have to be on deck for an extra 3 hours every afternoon, but it did change the workout dynamics in a very unexpected way for me. And I remember calling Jack after like a week of it, and I said, "Yeah, you're exactly right. Yep, this has presented some headaches and learning curves, but we figured it out by now, though. But it's great coming to work every day to have that kind of facility, and you just feel good about it. It feels good."
Yeah, it probably doesn't hurt with recruiting, because you
No.
always get these rave reviews coming out of visits, for the kids that visit Denison, so.
Well, it's a beautiful pool, and we stole as many good ideas from a lot of the facilities around that we found. And probably the one thing that I enjoy the most, and I was actually taking pictures of it this morning at practices, the windows. Well, some of the windows faced east, so we get the sunrise in the morning, and then the other side of the pool faces west, and we've got windows, so we get the sunsets at night, and the pool just lights up in all the great colors. And this morning we had this wonderful pinkish and orange hue coming through the facility windows, and it was just gorgeous. And all the colors were flying this morning. It made a very special morning for us.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. All right, let's go back to recruiting for a minute. So, when you're recruiting, you're going after swimmers who are also getting hit up by some really good D1 programs. And a lot of these kids, I see this with all of these athletes that we work with today. So many of them are just stuck in this, I have to go D1 mindset, just kind of tunnel vision, right? Even though the top end of D3 swimming is crazy fast, what do you say to them to shift their perspective? How do you sell them on Denison and your program?
Well, I think for a student athlete to be successful here at Denison specifically, we spend a lot of time just talking about the academic opportunities that come here. That I think for us, in many ways, the academic experience here, and especially how our students can connect with faculty members and also utilize Denison's year-round internship program, I think is a in many cases a tiebreaker for a lot of when we go up against some of these other schools. Our proximity to Columbus, Ohio, which is now the 14th largest city in the United States, and the resourcing that the university has accessed there, in the form of internships and shadowing opportunities and field experience has been great. I mean, the university accesses Columbus regularly. We have shuttles that run our students in and out of the city regularly. We're only 25 minutes from downtown. So for us, it's not really a swimming argument so much as it is an academic experience. And the fact that we can talk about smaller classrooms and personalized academic experiences and building important relationships with professors and faculty members and administrators. One of our big selling points is that I think we may have the only college president that comes to every prelim and final session of both conference and national championships.
Wow.
President Weinberg is probably our greatest fan. He doesn't miss a session at either conference or nationals. I've talked to peers at D1, D2, and D3, and they're like, "You got to be kidding me!" And then on top of it, I'll say, "Well, yeah, Adam makes a point of being at all of our sessions," and they're like, "Wait, you're on a first name basis with the president of the university?" And I'm like, "I sure am. We sit down and have lemonade or a glass of wine at least twice a year just to talk about the state of the college and to talk about the state of the program." And so, for us, the argument is really quite simple when you look at the academic opportunities that Denison avails to its students, on top of providing I think a quality swimming program in which, and I think we've been using been using your software program to point out to student athletes how our athletes are improving at the highest levels compared to no matter what division we're talking about, whether we're talking about D1, D2, or D3, Denison swimmers tend to improve more than just about anybody else. And the new facility behind us, with the new 50-meter facility, what that's done for us internationally has been huge because we're starting to get kids to Olympic trials and we can train seriously for meets that might lie outside the NCAA season. Obviously staying within NCAA rules, but I think that in and of itself, I think makes us a more attractive option for the serious swimmer who's got aspirations to swim beyond the NCAA season.
Yeah, we say this all the time. You have some of the best coaching staffs are not in Power Four.
Right.
And I think that sometimes that message goes in one ear and out the other. And so that's why we have the data to back it up. And you have done a phenomenal job with your program. And I think that history of success, has it made it easier to recruit? I mean, you've done this for 38 years now, right? You've had this history of national titles. You've seen so much development coming out of these swimmers. Does it get a little easier each year, or is each year still just sort of that same recruiting struggle?
Well, it doesn't get easier, I can tell you that, just simply because there's some the market is changing so quickly, especially with the transfer portal and NIL money and the Grant House settlement and all those things are impacting it. And it's such a moving landscape right now. And and there's new legislature being considered by the NCAA, which is they're talking about granting 5 years of eligibility, and what does that mean for a 4-year college, residential college that doesn't have grad programs? Think about how the landscape will change if all of a sudden that 5th year is granted. And so there's the market's changing quickly, and there's but I do think it helps to have the reputation of developing kids and to providing them with a environment where they can excel academically as well as athletically. My heartfelt belief is just because you happen to choose an academically centered institution in Central Ohio, that shouldn't preclude you from pursuing your swimming dreams to the nth degree. And we've been fortunate, like some other D3 schools, we've had kids swim internationally. We've had an Olympian here. And we've had kids compete at world championships and other major international meets. And all these kids had to improve substantially to get there. But at the same time, though, they're being provided with a world-class education. And I think that's what we're trying to provide with our kids. And I, Denison's not for everybody, but it is for the person that wants to have a really, I think, intimate experience in their academic and swimming experience. That's kind of what we're looking for.
When you told me the president attends every meet,
Yeah.
that is such a big important data point, because Everything about the college sports right now, everything's wild right now, right? Everything's changing. There's so much fear, uncertainty, and doubt. There's so much FUD. To have a program where the president actually takes an interest in your sport. Wow, that's big. I mean, that is not typical at all. And that's a huge recruiting bullet point.
I think it is huge. And I mean, and he knows all of our swimmers by name. He was not a swimmer. He was an ice hockey player actually in college. I went to a small liberal arts school, much like Denison. He went to a NESCAC. He apologizes for that chronically, we haven't gone to a NESCAC. But I think I was on part of the interview committee that interviewed President Weinberg when he took the job. And one of the things that stood out to me, and I think that this is true about what we're trying to do here. I remember when we lined up all the other candidates who were vying for the president's position here at Denison, he was the only candidate who talked about athletics as co-curricular, not extracurricular. He looks at what we do on the playing field, on the courts, in the back, in the pool, as a serious part of the student experience and education. And he values this at a very profound level. And Adam has family that competes. I mean, he comes from a very athletic, very intellectual family. He sees the value of what we do here and is quick to congratulate and quick to support. We're very, very fortunate. Like I said, I think it's a huge bullet point for us to know that the president's going to be there, and he knows our kids, and he knows what a good performance looks like. And it's not, in all the years, Adam's been here for, I think, now 12 years, and I think this is his 12th year. I've never felt pressure to having to perform either. It's just support, and it's all about process. And it's all about helping the young men and young women in our program move down the road towards adulthood so that they can be, graduate with a quality degree and be set up for a great future afterwards. But I've never felt the pressure to win, lose, or draw. It's always been positive.
So I like that term co-curricular because, the data backs this up. Being an NCAA athlete is a huge boost to your career, the rest of your career. You could have swam 40 years ago, and people will still say, "Did you swim at Syracuse?" I mean, that's something Benji DeMont tells me all the time. He'll say. People still come up to me and talk about swimming at Syracuse. Syracuse has had a program in how long? Decades, right? And so, that opens opportunities for you when you're getting a job, when you're going to graduate school. And for the parents that are on the fence, should I encourage my kid to swim in college or not? Yes, if they enjoy it, if they love the sport, it is co-curricular. It is not extracurricular. And if you have that drive to compete in a sport while doing the academics, the social, and all just the change in life, that speaks wonders to you on your resume, and that will follow you forever. And I love that term.
Yeah, I remember when I was sitting in the room when he was talking about that. I'm like, okay, this guy has already distinguished athletics from all the other candidates. And he gets it. Clearly he gets it. And like I said, as he said, he was a good hockey player, not a great hockey player. But like I said, just very fortunate to have him in there. And then again, as things, things flow downhill. And when you have a president who's on board, who values what we're doing here athletically in this in much in the same light that what we're experiencing academically, boy, that just affirms what our kids are going through in the most positive sort of way. It validates the path that they've chosen.
Okay, so you mentioned Grant, house settlement, NIL, all these things are changing, right? This question's coming. How do you think all of these changes are going to affect swimming in college at the D3 level? And specifically, what are the changes coming to Denison from this?
That's the million-dollar question, and I wish I had a better handle on it. I mean, things are changing, and I'm not an attorney, and I don't understand all the dynamics with Grant's settlement and everything like that. But what we do see is an influx of money coming into the sport, much of which is regulated, some of which is not. what that looks like. You know, I talked to some of my colleagues who are in D1 who are dealing with serious NIL money, who they are not only getting athletes but losing athletes. It's turned into the wild, wild west, and the winner is the highest bidder typically. And all you have to do is just, you know, follow these kids and where they end up landing. And you know, I don't know what the implications are for D3. I think NIL money will find its way down here. I think in time, it may already be present in some cases in some small ways. But you know, obviously, we're not dealing with a $10 million quarterback, you know, who's going to sign, you know, that kind of thing. But you know, we're, you know, Ohio State is just down the road from us, and we see the impact that their NIL money had on their football program. And you know, conversations with Bill Dorencott at Ohio State this fall was telling me about how the NIL money is impacting what he's trying to do, and you know, squad size limitations and things like that. I just don't know what that's going to look like in D3 at this point, but I do anticipate that NIL money will come our way. It will be a factor if it's not already. And I would think that Dennison wanting to remain competitive will adapt to those changing circumstances. Will we take the lead on that? I don't know. I think, you know, I think it's a lot of wait and see right now and trying to figure out exactly what the implications are, no matter how it goes. So yeah, I mean, I wish my crystal ball was clear. It's just really murky right now.
You know, when we look at swimming coaches as a profession, and we always like to look at development. You know, it's a key indicator of the success of a coach is how well you can develop athletes. If we look at football, we look at it a little differently in a different lens because development, okay, maybe, but now more than ever, a coach at a Power Four level, I don't think will have to worry about developing as much as they will, for lack of a better term, buying the talent, identifying and
Sure.
buying. And so it's we're seeing this with kids that, you know, we've helped it at the football level. You know, it's so many of these programs, they're like, no, I have to win right now. I'm transfer portal only. If you're in high school, unless you are, you know, insert big name here, right? You probably need to, you know, go, you know, earn your playing time at a mid-major and then move on up.
Right.
And but I don't think that's going to happen at the swimming level, at least not for the majority of schools. And I think development will still be a primary indicator of the success of a coaching staff at the swimming level.
Yeah,
So
I hope you're right. I really hope you're right. I hope we don't lose track of that altogether. I, you know, I remember talking to a couple co there, you know, there was a big transfer this past spring. With one of the big D1 guys, and all the winds were blowing him in one direction. So I called the coach of the school that is, and I'm like, "Are you gonna? It looks like you're gonna get so and so." And he goes, "No, nope, not getting so and so. The winds are turning the other direction now." I said, "Well, what happened there?" And he goes, "Well, it just got down to the money, and we just got outbid." And it was like, and you know, I felt really bad for the coach who lost the swimmer initially. Because it's like, oh man, you know, you brought this kid along. I mean, this kid developed under your tutelage, under your watch, and then he ran to the next highest bidder, and then he ran to the next highest bidder. And it was like, you know, and I just, you know, again, you know, I it's frustrating, I think, for a lot of people, you know, coaches in particular, because I think the good coaches are invested in the relationship and invested in the swimmer. And it's, I think our hearts are easily broken when we see kids break away from that. And you can't blame the kids. I mean, they're trying to take care of family in many cases and trying to, you know, create opportunity for themselves. But, you know, for coach, most of the good coaches are invested in the relationship to begin with. And it's not necessarily a business transactional, dynamic.
And I think, you know, swimming is also a different kind of sport because coaches have their own training philosophies. You have your secret sauce. Athletes acclimate to that training environment, and you can't, if you're flipping coaches every year, you're putting, you know, a big challenge, roadblock right in your way toward development. And so to that end, you know, I think the transfer portal, I'm really curious how the transfer portal is going to go. moving forward, given the fact that you don't have to sit out a year, given the fact that you can get NIL money. But for you, transfer portal, do you plan on using it more, or do you have a strong preference on building your athletes, from high school on?
Well, I have no problem with transfers. I mean, the university has been pretty transparent about it. Our president loves transfers, which is unlike his predecessor. His predecessor was not as big a fan of transfers, but our current president is a big fan of it. And we're going to exercise the transfer portal. I mean, my coaching staff pours over that, daily. We look for it and we try to find that one. We've had a couple transfers here over the years. Ultimately, we prefer, I can't say I have a preference for the kid who comes in for 4 years and finishes with us. I mean, you have a little bit more time to develop that relationship. I think there's opportunities there, but a transfer student, is also generally a more mature student. They're more seasoned. There's a different kind of learning curve when they arrive, and can we help them through that? So there are opportunities for us to, connect with them. But yeah, we're gonna leverage the transfer portal as much as we possibly can, just in large part to stay competitive, because that there's a lot of good swimmers out there. And there's a lot of good swimmers. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of these power fours are having to scale down their roster sizes. So a lot of the kids who were promised spots just a year or two ago, all of a sudden they're finding that opportunity is no longer available. And so if we can provide a quality student athlete with an opportunity here, then I'm okay with that. So.
Yeah, roster limits are going to hit. I don't know that we know exactly what that's going to look like. It seems to be a
Right.
little bit in flux. We've heard the Big Ten is settling at 30 men.
Right.
I don't know where the SEC is going to land. We've heard 22. I've heard 30. I don't know where it's going to be in the end. At ACC at the same way. I don't know exactly. It sounds like they're going to be around 30, but the teams that were carrying 40 and 40 to 45 men. That yeah, there's been some pain. There's been some
Yeah, I mean, and we're even,
drops and cuts.
we had a swimmer reach out to us who had made a commitment to one of the Power Fours as a junior. And notable swimmer, it's notable talent, and then got the phone call, just said, we can't, that spot we offered you a year ago is no longer available. And the kid was heartbroken, and all of a sudden he has to start the college search all over again. And you feel bad for him, but I it's I, again, I think the Wild Wild West is probably the best descriptor, of what's going on right now. And I don't think anybody's, I think basically in some cases it feels like the tail's wagging the dog right now. I'm not always sure if this is all good.
Yeah, I think it's like everything else. It'll be shades of gray. There'll be good parts and there'll be bad parts. But I don't. I've spent a lot of time trying to ease fear that college swimming is going away. I do not believe college swimming is going away. I believe power fours are going to limit rosters. I believe there's going to be some pain, but I truly believe that the meat and the heart of college swimming. Our mid-majors, D2s and D3s. This is where the volume of our coaches are, our kids are, and they're not as drastically impacted by what the Grant House settlement will do to the Power Four programs, who, quite frankly, their budgets are very dependent on what happens on Saturdays in the fall with football. And I don't know that's not necessarily it is definitely not true for most mid-majors. That their entire academic budget is dependent on the success of how they do in conference at a Power Four level.
Yeah, I think conversations that I'm having, casual conversations, nothing, not, I'm not on any committees or anything like that. I think casual conversations among the coaches is probably what happens if the Power Four decides to break away from the NCAA. That would be a earth mover. That would shift things tectonically in a pretty significant way, because D3 is dependent on those contracts, those television contracts. I mean, I think we get 1% of that t television revenue to fund all of Division III. And I know Division III has, so as long as Power Four stay in the game, I think we're going to be okay. And that's my hope. But I agree with you. I think College swimming in some will exist in some form or fashion. Hopefully at a varsity level as opposed to simply a club level. That's my hope is that we can stay within, stay fully sanctioned by the university as opposed to being relegated to a club level. And that's I think where we are realistically. So hopefully we can hold serve on that.
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge right now with the way these changes are shaking out is that you have kiddos. There's a report of a quarterback, junior in high school, gets a $10 million deal to go to a Power Four school, right? So these are now no longer amateur athletes. These are
Sure.
professional athletes, right? And you have one organization, the NCAA, that will be managing professional athletes like this one, as well as the majority, 66% of NCAA athletes do not play football or basketball.
Right.
So the heart of NCAA athletes are not going to be professionals.
Right.
And that is a weird dynamic now to have to govern what happens to the $4 or $5 million quarterback transfer, as well as, the rower or the wrestler or the gymnast. And I think that I don't know how well equipped the NCAA is to handle that balance right now.
Yeah, we're experiencing this on a family level. Our youngest of six sons is playing junior hockey up in Canada right now, and he's a pretty good hockey player. And I think that there's probably some place for him to play at some point. But when the NCAA allowed the CHL, the Canadian Hockey, these are paid players now to come down and are eligible to compete in the NCAA. All those spots that were available for the junior amateurs are now being taken up by these kids who've been paid. So there's, I mean, it's hitting on a lot of different levels with a lot of different sports, and how it's going to be wrangled in, or if it's going to be wrangled in at all, is going to be interesting. But because there's only so many spots and only so much money out there, so we'll see how it plays out.
Yep. Okay, let's shift to training. So we talked about
Yeah.
this a little bit, but so you've been doing this for almost 40 years. So ha has
Sure.
your as you're developing these athletes, you're staying on top, you're winning national titles, has your training philosophy changed much, or did you lock in early on in your career on what works? And how much do you adapt to, the new science and the trends that are happening in swimming?
Well, I think we figured out what works. I think how we get it to work has changed radically. Obviously, the science of swimming has changed quite a bit. I mean, I'm a product of the 60s and 70s and early 80s in my own training. The old days were, the 20,000 meter days, the Mission Viejo days and things like that. We all heard the horror stories come out of Schubert's program. And but the science has changed, and as a physiologist, I think I'm obligated to try to keep up on the science as best I possibly can. Talk to coaches and professionals out there who know a lot more about this sport than I do, and witness and ask questions and observe, how things are getting done. But yeah, it was interesting you asked this question. Yeah, I had a couple of the guys in my office the other day, and I keep all my workouts. I've had workouts from when I was coaching club in high school back in the 1980s. And one of the guys got into the workouts, and they're looking at these things. And it's like, Coach, here's a really good set. Why don't we ever do this? And I'm like, because it would kill you. You wouldn't survive that set. And I look back, I spent some time up at Club Wolverine with Urbancheck when he was, dealing with, coaching Carlton Bruner, and he had Dolan and Melchow and Kerry Hale. And I look at the volume of training that they're putting out there compared to what we're doing now. And the science has changed. I don't think the kids have changed. I just think we're getting smarter at what we're doing. And I think we have a much better understanding as to how rest and recovery factor into the sport. I thought Dave Marsh said it really well. We used to train to train, now we train to race. And I think that was a significant shift in people's paradigms and mindsets. And so I think, we're training differently than we used to, and I think we're getting more out of what we do. And it's not only just a physiological, I think the other piece you got to take into account is the environmental changes that are, I mean, I think the kids are exposed to different stresses now than they did maybe 10, 15 years ago. The post-COVID era has been particularly challenging for a lot of our young people, and And making sure that you're tuned into that and making sure that you're taking emotional and mental health care is important, you know, seriously, just like you would, you know, whether or not you're training their bodies properly. So I think it's multifaceted. I think if you're going to be in a good coach, you got to be tuned into all that. I mean, my own personal opinion is that peak performance is a perfect storm between body, mind, and heart, and you've got to have all those things lined up. And how we get those things lined up is unique to each athlete. But I do think there's certain rules that you carry. And I mean, I think if you want to be a good swimmer, you obviously have to have really good technique. You got to have adequate aerobic capacity. You've got to have adequate anaerobic power, and you've got to have some speed. And how does strength and all those things come into it? Now, how we get to those things, I think, has maybe changed a little bit over the last, you know, decade or a couple decades. But I think that's the fun part of our job, is that the sport does keep changing. That's what keeps coming you back, bringing you back every year.
Yeah, a big part of our research at Swim and Tell has been looking at how clubs train, because obviously we have hundreds of thousands of kids at the club level, and you know this because you've seen what we do and you use what we do, but it's understanding how those swimmers that you're recruiting have been training through high school, and how that will correlate to their success at your program and other programs as well. And the things that we have seen, and we've absolutely seen a shift in philosophy across a lot of clubs, but at the same time, a lot of stubbornness and hubris to keep doing 20,000 yard days, right? So we see that. And some things that I that we have noticed, and they're not just becoming anecdotal. You're starting to see a trend. Some of the clubs that get a lot out of their swimmers when they're young, but they're throwing them into 10,000 yard days at the age of 12 and 13. We're seeing more burnout by the time they get to the college level, and that goes to your point, right? It's not just about physically, can I do it? It's mentally as well. So we do see some burnout. We do see a more tendency for injuries when we have our 12 and 13 and 14 year olds swimming 10,000 yards a day. Yeah, they're getting a lot out of them. They're getting that gold medal, that silver medal club, USA club designation, but at what cost, right? Are they really prepping them for college? And it's not just a yardage game. I've seen some incredible performances coming out of, short yardage clubs. You don't have to swim 100 100s once a week to get a lot out of these kids.
Or ever.
Ever. Please don't ever do that. So yeah, it's interesting. Are you looking more at where these kids are coming from and the training that they've had through high school, and assessing how they'll do it at Denison from that? Or does it really not matter? You're going to take them and you're going to change their training, and they're going to have that same effect.
I think there are some clubs and high schools out there, I think, that do a really, really good job of setting their kids up for the college experience. I think that they have the kids mentally, emotionally, in a place where they can take advantage, take the next step. They've prepared them well. And there are programs that come to mind. And there's some other programs that, frankly, I don't think do quite as good a job. And I think a lot of it is because of the amount of pressure those kids are feeling in high school and club. It's like perform now. So by the time they get to the college ranks, there's not much gas left in the tank. And so, yeah, we're aware of some programs that I think have maybe a little bit better reputation, better track record of sending, of having success among their college swimmers. And then we also, I think in the recruiting process, we're pretty transparent about our training philosophy and our training schedule. We have a demanding program. I think that's why we get results, but I don't think it's foolishly demanding. I think it's intelligently demanding. But I think, we're looking, there's some people, I think, who come out of very limited backgrounds who will struggle with, let's say, the volume of workouts that we do here. And I think we have to vet those candidates carefully, because ultimately we want to set the young men and young women up for success. We don't want to see anybody come in here and just struggle constantly. And I think that there are better fits out there. And we know the kind of student athlete that fits well into our program. It's generally somebody who's coming from, who's been well coached, where there's been demands, there's been a history of doing doubles. There's probably a little bit of background in dry land, at least, or an appreciation for dry land training. But there's a work ethic here. I mean, we're unapologetic about the kind of work that we do here. And I do think that that's why we're getting the results that we do. But a lot of it has to do with best fit. Not only does the candidate vet us and understand what they're getting into, but we're vetting them to make sure that we're setting them up for success. And I think that just takes a lot of dialogue between the coaches and the recruit, the coaches and the parents, the coaches and the swimmers' coaches back home, just so that we get familiar with them. I mean, we've had swimmers who come into our program who came out of, let's say, pure USRPT programs. I mean, the 2,000-yard maximum workout. That's been a struggle. That athlete has struggled in our program just simply because, you know, we have warm-ups that are longer than that. And so I would never describe us as a high volume program, but we do think that there is some volume that needs to be taken care of, you know. So yeah, it's all about best fit, making sure that you're transparent about expectations and standards.
Yep. You know, you mentioned you're going to work hard. This is what works. It's funny because you'll see swimmers that, and I've seen this over and over again. You'll see swimmers where they'll go through training, they'll work hard. Some will come out of it and go, "Man, I hurt, but this feels good. I that was hard, but that was fun." And then you have others that, and I've seen this, again, firsthand. That was hard, and I don't feel good. That was hard, and that wasn't fun.
Right.
And I think that's. I'm willing to bet that's part of the secret sauce of longevity as a coach is figuring out, how do you get these athletes to work hard, not burn out, have fun, have a good culture? Because you have great retention. Your retention's been fantastic. And the athletes that come out of Denison love Denison. You have evangelists all over the country. And
Right.
so I'm curious if you ever thought about that. Is that part of the you're gonna work hard, but you're gonna like it, you're gonna like the results? Kind of philosophy.
Well, I do think so. I mean, you know, ultimately, you know, I think most of the people coming through the door want to get better. And I think if that's my job is to help them develop. And but we also we're like I said, we don't apologize for the fact that we are going to work hard. And it's not hard work for hard work's sake. It's hard work because you're going to get some results and have some fun along the way. And that's part of that team culture that we talk about. You know, we're big fans of the concept of synergy here, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, where you start stacking energy. You know, one single log itself can only contain so much energy, but if you stack 10 with a similar amount of energy, then the heat increases exponentially, not algebraically. And that's how we train, that's how we compete here. And I think that that makes a difference. And we talk about that all the time with the kids that, you know, sometimes we don't, let's admit it, you know, sometimes we don't have the juice to do it for ourselves, but we can usually find the juice to do it for our mates. All you got to do is look to your right and look to your left, and you can find it for somebody else. I mean, that's my life as a parent, right? Sometimes I won't do it for myself, but if my kid asks me to do anything, I can always find more juice for my kids. Well, it's no different than being a part of a good team, is that you want to be able to be available and be reliable for your teammates. And so, you know, the team piece of it, I think, makes it satisfying. I think it makes everybody feel like they're rooted into something pretty special and adds a lot of energy and excitement to what they're doing and fun, to your point, fun.
And that's culture, right? That's part of culture.
Sure it is.
Okay, so you mentioned something. You mentioned training, not training for training's sake, but training for racing. And
Right.
I love I'm fascinated. We're doing the research on, in-season development. What motivates the kids? Of course, this question is coming about dual meets. So dual meets are part of your in-season assessment. What's your take on dual meets? Do you like the way they are right now? Do you think swimming needs to shake things up and make them more exciting for fans, change the format to be more of a preparation for championships? Like if you could change anything, if you had a blank slate, what would you do with in-season racing?
I've hated dual meets for most of my career, but actually in recent years, we've been doing some really creative stuff with our dual meets. And what, you know, I know that, you know, Cal and Stanford do their triple distance dual meets, you know, which I thought was really correct. We've done that. We have actually adopted the high school event format. We do half distances, we do double distances. We just, and I'm fortunate to have a group of coaches that we do meets with regularly that are also kind of outside the box thinkers. So, we have a meet this weekend on Saturday, and it's a 22 event format. It's nowhere in the rule book. But we're swimming 22 different events. And it's just a mixed bag of stuff. And the other coach and I are both kind of in the same spot trying to get some data points so that we can make some informed decisions going to championships about events. We're not scoring the meet, so it takes some of the pressure off for the coaches to be able, okay, to, you know, so we're not worrying about gathering points. We're just really there to watch the kids swim. And we're opening it up. Every kid gets to swim six events. And it's just, so we're trying to be creative with it. And I think, too often we get caught up in orthodoxy, and the next thing you know is we're just following the rule book, and there's no creativity in that. And I think coaches can find ways to bring more fun and enjoyment to it. And we try to do it our way here. I mean, we have a meet traditionally where we go 100-yard relays. I mean, what kid doesn't like to get up and sprint 100 medley relay? I mean, that's like the fat that might be the most fun relay in the history of the books. I wish I had had the opportunity to do it, but we're stuck with swimming. We had only three relays back in my era. We didn't have the 200s. And so I think there's all sorts of ways to get creative with stuff. We're fortunate at our pool that we have a bulkhead and we can put the starting blocks on the bulkhead and the end of the pool. When we do that 100-yard relay at his pool, they don't have that luxury. So our kids use running dives.
Wow.
I mean,
That's
yeah. I
awesome.
mean, and our kids can't wait. They can't wait. They're like, are we swimming so and so at their pool or our pool this year? And I was like, well, we're doing it at our pool. And they're like, oh, not that. We want to do the running dives. So I think there's all sorts of ways to get there to make it more fun for the kids and make it more engaging. At the same time, still be productive. I mean, I don't want to come across as like making this sound like it's just recess, but I do think that there's some play. I do think it is fun. I think it is engaging for our kids. I think they do have a good time with it. And so I think coaches can be more creative if you can find that willing partner on the other side of the pool is willing to engage that way. And it's taken me a while to find those coaches out there who want to break the orthodoxy and try some different stuff. And we're lucky to have found them.
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that's so strange about dual meets is that the format is nothing like the championship meet. Nothing. And so, it's not that it has to absolutely prepare you for championship meets, but if all you did were dual meets, that would be like going through a football season playing, 7-on-7, two quarters of football, and then okay, now in the playoffs we're gonna do
Yeah.
four quarters, 11-on-11. And so I think I'm not sure that the dual meet format is conducive to preparing athletes for what championships are like. And we've talked to, Coach Parisi last episode talked about how he greatly prefers invitationals because they're structured more like what will happen at the end of the season. And I think that's a great point. We've talked to coaches who they just train right through all meets. They don't, they, you know, you'll swim fast at the end. And I think mentally that can be very difficult because you don't have that sense of progress through the season. And I think that can really mess with your head, especially if at the end of the year you get the flu or you have a
Oh,
bad taper or something, right? And then you really don't know what you did.
well, Brian does a great job at Akron. I mean, we've known Brian for a long, long time, and I have seen his model. He has been adding more and more invites because I think, to your point, I think it does get you better prepared for championships and having to get up on the blocks, whether it's a prelim final format or not. We go to one of his invitationals in October every year, and it's a great primer for us to get the season started, and I think it gets the kids off to a good start. So yeah, I think. We're only limited by our imagination. And, I looked at like what Arizona State did, what Irby did with the beer wagon, in the fall. They brought the beer wagon out on the pool. That I've just got it. I talked to my AD. I said, can we do that too? And she was like, oh yeah, we could probably figure that out, And so I think there's all sorts of ways to get creative out there to make it more fun for more spectator friendly as well as fun and enjoyable for the swimmers. It shouldn't be a grind all the time. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having some fun with this because most of the kids got into this sport because it is fun.
We worked, it was a club level meet, but we worked with one of the clubs that we work with. They had a mid-season taper meet, and they had a sponsor who made the meet insanely exciting. So
Sure.
they had they brought out food trucks, they had t-shirts, they
Nice.
had a laser light show, they had a
That's
DJ.
awesome.
And so, you know, going back to your point about how it's not just about physical, it's about mental, the kids were so, they had so much adrenaline after the walkout music, going into finals, they swam out of their mind. And part of it
Right.
was just the energy that created. And I think sometimes as a sport, we do ourselves a disservice by not trying to create an environment that really gets, you know, our athletes in that right mindset, as well as for the fans as well. I think there's things that we can do, getting creative with those in-season races.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Again, I think we're only limited by our imaginations, and I don't consider myself an imaginative person. I just like, okay, that looks interesting. Let's do the high school format this year. That'd be kind of fun. That'd be something different, you know. So three relays instead of two. It's pretty cool.
Okay, last question.
Yeah.
Besides swimming, and I know you have been involved in a lot of other sports. You
Yeah.
volunteer as a youth hockey coach, youth baseball coach, but besides swimming, what's your favorite sport to watch at Denison? Like, you know, what gets you fired up to just sit back and be a fan at a sport at Denison?
Probably ice hockey. I coached ice hockey for 25 years. We have a club level program here. My kids grew up on that rink. Like I said, I coached for 25 years. I enjoy a great hockey game when it's played well, and we play pretty decent hockey here for club level. And like I said, it's rooted in my family memories and my time on the ice with the boys. And so, I can also enjoy a really well played baseball game too, just sitting in the bleachers and just with the sun on my face, especially after I've been indoors all winter. It's nice to get out there and just enjoy a good baseball game.
Yeah, you know, I'm the same way. I played baseball all my life, and sometimes I, you know, people are like, why do you watch this game? I love this game. I don't know why
Yeah.
I love this game. I played it since I was like 3 years old. So that was,
Did you grow up in New York?
no, I grew up in Kentucky. So I grew up in rural Kentucky. So it's where, and it was a time when you played every sport you could get your hand on.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I swam. I played tennis. I played baseball. But baseball was the love of my life. And I, if I
Are
wasn't
you a Reds fan? Are you a Reds fan?
Yes,
That's
unfortunately,
okay. I
yes.
know you. Hey, listen, Big Red Machine, Sparky Anderson, Johnny Bench, Pete Rose,
Yes.
Joe Morgan, Concepcion Perez. I mean, that was my favorite team in the 70s. If it wasn't the Tigers, it was the Reds.
Oh, I love the Reds. I've seen so many Reds games, and I long for the days of the Reds making the playoffs and being competitive. But yeah, that's.
So one of our parents, one of the parents of our alumni, is the owner of Henny Penny Chicken Fryers. That's what he does. He makes, and he is actually a minority owner with the Reds.
Oh,
And
wow.
so he, whenever the Tigers go to play the Reds, I end up getting two of the platinum, actually up to four platinum seats right behind home plate. And I mean, he treats us really well. And I've been down to Cincinnati's new stadium a couple times. What a beautiful
It
park that is.
is. It
Yeah.
is. It is great. It's such a fun thing to do. I love going
Yeah.
to any baseball game I can go to. But you know, my kids, they do not understand why I like this game. So
Oh,
they're
wow.
swimmers, so it's fine. It's fine.
Oh.
I love swimming just as much, but as a baseball fan, sometimes it's hard to explain. And I'll tell you something else that's really challenging. If you've ever been to a baseball game with somebody who doesn't understand the rules of baseball, you
Uh-huh.
think it's going to be easy to explain it until you go through and you do it. And then you're like, wow, this is actually a complicated game.
It is a complicated game. So, I quick story. My grandfather was vice president of Borden, back when Borden was in New York City, and as part of his job, he was basically given four season tickets to the Yankees, and he had them basically starting in 1932 up until the time Steinbrenner bought. So imagine all the teams that he saw, but he had had a bad business dealing with George Steinbrenner. And these seats were 19 rows up off the first baseline, right behind the dugout. I mean, there are just
God.
so when Steinbrenner bought the team, my grandfather was so upset he sold the tickets without telling anybody. And I'll never forget the phone call. We're living in Michigan at the time, and my mother screams at the I thought maybe my dad had died or something like that. And she's like, "You did what?" And she threw the only time I ever saw her lose her mind, and it was because my grandfather had sold the Yankees tickets, and we and haven't seen them since. They're all
No.
gone back in the 1970s. Oh my God, what a painful day in our household.
That is a great story.
Yeah, so
Okay, Coach.
baseball. Yep.
That is awesome. Coach, thank you so much for being on the show. I really
Yeah, thank
appreciate it. This
you.
was fantastic. And I'm really excited to see how D3 championships go for you guys. I know you guys are
Thank
going to be
you.
right in the thick of it. So
It'd
it's
be
going to be
fun.
really fun to watch. So again,
Well,
thank you so much.
thanks for thinking of us, and I really appreciate it. This has been great. Okay, got a great show going.
All right, thank you. Good luck the rest of the season, Coach.
All right, thank you.
All right.